everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for August 2017. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by the baby driver himself, Tim Nelson. Because if you're ever riding in a car and you see a traffic jam approaching, you want Timothy Nelson behind the wheel.
What happened?
Like reflexes. Remember?
Did I save our lives?
Yes. We're driving to the movie, ladies and gentlemen, the movie that we'll be discussing today. And lo and behold, there is a traffic jam. I mean, it is backed up. There is a standstill.
Yes.
Tim just flicks the wheel. Suddenly, we're on an alternate route, and we end up getting to the movie probably faster than we would have. That is what Tim Nelson brings to the table.
I miss my calling, and I should be some sort of professional driver.
Yeah, for Kevin Spacey, preferably. But
I hope
so.
It didn't really work out good for anybody that worked for him in the movie Baby
Driver. It's a good point. Didn't work out for him. Yeah. Well,
no, dead.
Spoiler.
Sorry.
Spoiler alert. All right. Here we are, Tim. This is it. This is the last official month of the summer movie season. How cool is that?
I don't know.
It's been kind of a bummer.
I don't know how cool it is. I'm like, please end and get an award season as soon as possible.
It's not been good. Let's be honest. There's been a few good movies. I mean, you know, like you got Wonder Woman was great. Dunkirk. We liked it. That
we
was a highlight.
It. Go check it out, the review, and
Spider-Man was good. But, you know, overall, yeah, it was kind of a bummer of a summer. And I am ready for the award season. I'm hoping Hollywood saved the best for last year because, yeah, it's been an off year. And we've talked about it.
But good things are still ahead.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
Like the Telluride Film Festival, I went to go book a play. I'm going to Colorado. I went to go book a hotel in Telluride, and I couldn't.
Ah.
And I was like, what the heck's going on? The film festival's coming up.
There it is.
And last year's Best Picture came out of that film festival. And so I'm like, you know, roll the dice. Maybe.
Who knows?
These late season film festivals in Colorado or somewhere else will deliver another Best Picture like last year.
That's what's exciting. You don't know what's coming. And then there it is. And it's like this movie that's just this best kept secret waiting for us. So I'm hoping, man. I'm really, really hoping. In that vein of kind of a bummer of a summer, we've had a change of plans. We were originally going to review The Dark Tower. As some of you might have remembered, we mentioned that at the end of our last podcast, but The Dark Tower's a bomb.
I didn't see it. You told me don't see it.
Yes, you've been warned here first. We don't like bombs because they hurt us, and we did not see The Dark Tower, so guys, it didn't happen. I'm sorry. It's at a 16%. On Rotten Tomatoes.
Holy crud.
Okay. So that's not good.
That's awful.
Let's look at some of the quotes here. We got, let's see. Kate Walsh says, inconsistent, incoherent, and cheesy. Lena Lazic says, not even bad enough to be fun. Oof. And Peter Travers of Rolling Stone says, so much is so wrong about this stunted film version of Stephen King's marvelously dense and dazzling series of novels that all I can say is this unholy mess shouldn't happen to a king, much less a paying customer.
Dang, this is like what my ex-girlfriends might say about me. That's terrible, man. That's terrible.
It is terrible. So we just decided to flat out skip it. Stunted. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That was a one-star review from Rolling Stone. So instead, we have switched gears a bit, and I do think it would be fun to review a really bad movie sometime, but it is difficult to want to waste that time and that energy when we could watch something better. It's kind of sad just because, like, Dark Tower was in development for, like, a decade. Like, all you just kept hearing over and over, like, oh, Viggo Mortensen's going to star. Oh, Ron Howard's going to direct it. And then people keep dropping out, and then here we go. We finally get it, and ugh.
Bleh.
Terrible. Oh, well.
And we don't even know it's terrible.
We don't know.
It's so bad
that
we can trust everyone.
Yeah, you know, this is why I believe in Rotten Tomatoes. It's just, it's hard to believe that if only 18% of, on average, 200 critics liked a movie, yeah, I just, those odds are not in your favor.
No.
No. So, anyway, the real bummer of it is that we decided to not see the really bad film and instead see something that was really highly rated on Rotten Tomatoes.
By a great director.
And we didn't actually end up liking it either. probably not as bad as we would have not liked Dark Tower, but the movie we are seeing today, we both walked away disappointed as well.
And kind of offended.
Offended, I would say. Yeah. But this is a movie that's 83% on Rotten Tomatoes. 83% of a couple hundred critics liked it. We'll take those odds any day. But yeah, here we go. We'll see. The movie in question that we are going to be reviewing today is Detroit. Detroit. That is the movie. So, Tim, let's get to it, man. Detroit. Have you ever been there? Have you ever been to Detroit?
Probably once, but I'm actually going to Detroit.
Why?
In like for the Christian Community Development Association meeting.
Yes.
I'm going to that in October.
I heard those CCDA meetings are amazing.
They're great. If our listeners want to, if you're interested in Christian Community Development, we'll give them a little plug. John Perkins, you might know him from Switchfoot Songs or whatever. I don't know how you know him, but
he is in a Switchfoot song, yeah.
But yeah, definitely a great thing. So I'll plug that a little bit if you ever get a chance to go. It's in Chicago next year. So some of us Midwesters, it's a little bit easier. It's very centrally located. But yeah, I'm going to Detroit. I think Detroit in the last 10 years has become infamous, right?
Yes.
And so I think that the title is almost controversial. When you hear Detroit, you think there are certain things that you think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Bigelow was trying to draw some of that.
Yes. And I mean, I grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I never, ever went to Detroit. Not once. I don't think I've ever been there, still to this day. It's kind of sad.
Because why would you go to Detroit, right?
I don't know. I mean, I wasn't a sports fan when I lived in Michigan, so the Lions weren't a draw, and they weren't good for most of my life, you know? So I don't know.
Plus, it follows, right? It follows right in Detroit?
Yeah.
You don't want to go there, man.
No, I don't want super tall demons showing up in my bedroom. That's creepy.
But it's amazing how many films have a backdrop of Detroit. Gran Torino is a backdrop of Detroit. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it's this backdrop of like contrasting the industrial and the humanity.
Mm.
So it's like this machine that gets contrasted with the humanity of someone, or decay.
Yes.
Decay is kind of the last 10 years and more than that, more the last 40 or 50.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think it's a cool backdrop. It's like, it's the ideal American city in 1960 or whatever.
Motor City.
Right.
It's
Motor
it.
City. Motown comes from there. Yeah, it had a real heyday. But now it's considered kind of, I mean, there's hope now. I don't want to go after Detroit because we live in Milwaukee. So how can we go after Detroit?
Right.
We better,
But that has been the narrative. You're right, especially recently.
The narrative is, and then I know that there's pockets of like, well, people are looking at it as like urban frontier kind of stuff where you can like read, come up with more creative ideas for the future as artists and culinary artists and entrepreneurs and all these things that you can't do. It's almost like Wild West things that you couldn't do in other places because of the decay. So it's interesting.
Yeah. So that's Detroit. I'm sure, our experiences are quite different from the actual inhabitants who grew up there, but it's quite a name for a movie. Like you said, it's really just when you name a movie after a city, there's some expectations that go into that, and you feel like you're going to be watching something that really clues you into kind of the heart of the city, its history, warts, beauty, citizens, this big immersive sort of thing. And I think it starts off that way, but actually, we should back up because Detroit starts off with an animation. An animation, Tim. Now, I think this got under my skin more than it got under your skin,
but not just you. Like when I was reading reviews, like critics were like, "What?
I just don't
How
get
inappropriate
it.
Is this?"
Exactly. Like, can we just stick to newsreel footage? I think that's probably appropriate in a live action film. I just don't get it. This animation. What can you describe? And then it's the way.
It's like kooky animation.
Yes.
Too.
Yes.
Like what? It's kind of like silly almost. Like. Yeah, this is the Black experience in America. Ha ha ha. Like, and you're like, what? You're like, what is this tone that you're setting? You're like, silly animation.
It's what it felt like. What were they describing in the animation? Do you remember? Can you
I think they
break
were trying
down?
To like talk about, in general, they're talking about how does hyper-segregation exist in American cities? And they're talking about African Americans. They were trying to basically take something that's very complex and simplify it.
It was very simplistic.
And
it was basically like, okay, black people moved up from the South, the white people fled, and then you got a whole bunch of black people in one space, and what's going to happen? Right? It's basically.
Of course, a riot.
Of course, riots are going to break out.
So this is, it sets you up with some bizarre logic. Yeah. it doesn't really create causation because this film's about, well, I don't know what this film's about exactly, but it's drawing from the 67 Detroit riots. It's the 50th anniversary this year. And it was just some very strange ideas of what caused the riots.
Yep.
And like if you went by the history of the animation, it was like, well, if you get a dense enough grouping of black folks, there will be riots. And I found that like immediately offensive.
Yeah,
I'm like, what? Exactly. This is crazy.
Right.
Like we would not say that. I don't know how anyone gets away with saying something like that. So like if you have like a dense grouping of like white folks, is there going to be riots? I just don't understand that.
Yeah.
And then even the way that the riots, because the riots kind of opened the film, this, like you said, took place in 67, and the way the riots come about seem very, very, what's the word? It just sort of happens. Like you have this raid on a nightclub, which is actually where it did all start, but then it just feels like just so casual, like, you know what? Let's just take out this window, and then people start looting, and it just feels like there's so much more to the story that we're not getting. Right.
Right. And we're getting it from, these perspectives are very interesting. And I think what's really hard, I was thinking about this, since we watched the film, is that Bigelow has been made films about kind of soldiers.
The Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
That was her big one. And Best
Zero
Picture
Dark
winner.
30, right?
Zero Dark 30 with Jessica Chastain about getting Osama bin Laden. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so she makes these soldier movies about kind of extreme acts. And there are character studies a lot of times, but I think it's hard for her to, and I could be wrong, but it seems like it's hard for her to get away from empathizing with soldiers and cops. And I think it's really hard to have to come in to a film and have all that background, because she did a lot of background stuff for those other films.
Yes.
And then come in and then have to kind of turn your back on soldiers and cops if you wanted to give this narrative.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
And so I think she was not the person to make this film.
I don't think so either. And that's been some of the criticism from, especially the black community. It's like, why is this movie that is predominantly about the black experience in Detroit being made by a white director with a white writer? It's strange.
The writing is like was one of the biggest critiques I saw, which is, okay, you can be a white director if your material is coming from somebody that has firsthand experience of this. So the writing is really critical.
Yep.
So even with, what was it? Oh, I know what the example that I saw in one of my reviews, you may have seen this review too. I think it was on the Ebert website.
Yes. Yeah.
And it was saying, well, The Color Purple is directed by Steven Spielberg, but the writer has actually had experiences like this.
There you go. Yep.
And so it's okay that Spielberg is directing this and bringing that director, that force that he has. Just like nobody doubts that Bigelow has a gift for action and a gift for tension. Nobody doubts that.
Yeah.
But do you really want to have a white person describe the black experience?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. That seems like you're on some pretty weird, shaky ground at that point.
Right. And because no one's doubting that. Everyone went into this with the best of intentions, but one of the things that you realize when you really just kind of take a look in the mirror is that as white people, there are implicit biases that we have, and it's a lot of times we don't see them, and that is going to leak out. And I think it did in this movie, at least from the perspective of a lot of black people, that they were offended by the way the movie was presented. And I think, again, unintentional, but that's what can happen.
It shows you like a little bit of like what I think of my own. I mean, this is hard to talk about because we're two white guys, right?
Right, exactly.
But what I would say is it shows a lot of what is acceptable within our own cultural mores, which would be, oh, if you get a bunch of black people together, that's dangerous.
Right.
Like that was, she presented that as if that's totally acceptable. And what I would say is that's not only is that like untrue, it's actually a counter narrative, right?
Yes.
Like that we see, which is like, well, who's actually in danger in these situations?
Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
These white folks?
Yes.
Like, you know?
And that's
wild.
Yeah. And during that riot scenes, that's kind of how it's presented is it's almost like these black people are thugs and it's the white people that you start to feel kind of bad for. And it's like, wait a second.
What kind of whack narrative is this?
Yeah.
So I felt that like there's a bunch of things we can get into the writing
because
that's a real, this is highly problematic. Yeah.
Yeah.
A highly problematic script.
And, well, and the pacing is strange, right? Because I remember you leaned over to me and you're like, dude, the pacing in this movie,
well,
right?
The guy next to me snoring. It's not Dave. It's not Dave McDonald.
No.
The guy next to me is snoring and he's there like the dude was ready for this movie.
Yeah.
Like, and he wanted this movie to be interesting and he's falling asleep. So it was a pacing issue that wasn't about anything but a lack of believable tension.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or it was a sad, tired storyline that just kind of kept going on and over and over again.
Well, let's back up here. So we start off again with the movie's called Detroit. We start off with these riots, this kind of explanation of what's going on. And then for a while there, it kind of follows this big, expansive sort of city bird's eye view. We meet some characters that we don't see again, and we're kind of jumping from place to place. So you get this feeling that this is going to be kind of this homage to Detroit. And then the weird thing is that like 40 minutes into it, suddenly we zoom in and we suddenly realize that no, there's actually a main character that we haven't met yet. And the whole entire thing comes screeching to a halt in this one incident, which is historical, at the Algiers Motel. But like, it's strange because, like I said, the movie's skipping around and then all of a sudden we're basically in one room for like an hour. And that's just a strange way to tell your story. And then, of course, it ends with like a courtroom thing. It's almost like the movie's trying to be three different things in one, and it's jarring.
What I think is interesting is that Bigelow has mastered this idea of the individual decision making that leads to an individual's decision making can like lead to a disaster. Okay, mm-hmm. Like she gets that. You see that in her films,
mm-hmm.
Or somebody's hubris, or somebody's sociopath can destroy things. Mm. Okay, we get that. That's not what's going on the riots, because there's systems, right?
Yep. Yes.
It's like there's systemic oppression that's going on, and what I see in this film is she blames the systemic oppression on one white cop that's a bad apple.
Right, right.
Which misses the entire black critique.
Yes.
And I'm like, wow, you're not even in the conversation. Like, you might disagree with that idea, but you're not even, like, on the conversation. You can't even see what the critique is.
Yes.
That would lead to people rioting, right?
Because, because anyone who does research on what actually happened, you're seeing all these problems in education and employment and poverty and stuff, right? I mean, it's all right there, but none of that comes through in the movie.
The only thing that gets brought up is density.
Density, yeah.
And you're like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah, and to me that's like, what? Then why aren't we having riots in, like, Midtown Manhattan?
Right.
So that to me is whack.
Well, let's talk about that primary incident that takes up the majority of the running time here. So this was an actual thing that happened in Detroit in 1967 at the Algiers Motel. So we're introduced to a bunch of characters eventually, like after 40 minutes of prologue, I guess. You think that's what the movie's going to be, and then it switches to this other thing. But basically, so we got this racist cop that Tim alluded to, played by Will Poulter. His name is Krause. Okay, so Krause clearly does not have respect for black bodies. We see him shooting a looter in the back twice with a shotgun for looting a store. So this is a dude who believes, you know, in law and order, right? Very little value for human life. And then we're introduced to a few other important characters. So one of them is this lead singer of an aspiring Motown group called the Dramatics. And that's kind of where we finally settle into what the movie's actually about. So this guy's name is Larry, and he's the lead singer of this band. And they're about to go on stage, and kind of it's their big breakthrough. And then, oh, they can't go on because of some contrived, like, everyone has to leave the building. So then what ends up happening is Larry and his friend, who's kind of like the, I don't know what part he had in the band. He's kind of maybe the band's manager or something.
Bouncer, promotional, mm-hmm. Blah, blah, blah.
His name's Fred. They end up at the Algiers Motel, and they get a room. And they end up hitting it off with a couple white girls there, and those girls lead him to a party that's happening in one of the rooms. And so that's kind of what happens there. And then we're also getting introduced to a black security guard. And he was Finn from Force Awakens. John Boyega, I think is his name.
Because we can't get actual African-Americans.
Because he's British.
We have to get British guys to play our
yes.
black guys.
Yes.
I'm not.
I know.
We're more comfortable that way.
Exactly.
Sorry, I'm a little cynical here.
It's okay. So this black security guard, basically, he's there to sort of protect this shop from the owner of the shop has hired him. He's working like triple shifts to protect from the looting and the rioting that's happening. And so we're introduced to all these characters, and what ends up happening is this guy at one of the parties ends up shooting with a toy, like a plastic toy gun, at the police officers from up high in his room. It's not a real gun. It's just like a toy gun. But they think it's like a sniper. And so the police, led by Krause, this racist cop, descends on the Algiers Motel, and all the characters we've been introduced for end up winding up in this same room together. Krause is basically like, we need to find out who the sniper was, we need to find the gun, and all of the people, the two white girls, Larry and Fred, they're all lined up on the wall with their hands up, and they're forced to go through this terrible racist encounter with Krause and his police force as they play mind games, basically, with these black people to try to get to the bottom of who the shooter is. And that takes up, like, most of the movie, this incident. So what are your thoughts on this part of the story that we kind of become trapped in for a very, very long time? Tim.
So apart from being, like, kind of weird and offensive,
mm-hmm.
I thought it was boring.
Mm.
So that was the worst part, is like the beginning of it's like so interesting. You're like, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to see how John Boyega navigates all these difficult situations where he has to be like mooky and do the right thing kind of. And he's like trying to make peace. He's trying to do the right thing the whole time.
Right. He kind of he's a character who understands, the oppression that's happening to his black brothers and sisters. But he's also kind of playing both sides, where he's also bringing coffee out to the National Guard who's out there.
But in the end, he ends up being a punk.
Yes.
But that doesn't get highlighted. Like, they're missing. There's like this whole story that doesn't get, I say exploited, but there's this whole story that doesn't even get, there's nobody mined for it, and there's
mm-hmm.
gold there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And instead, we got this, like, it's almost like we're watching Die Hard or something, and it just happens to be, oh, this evil cop, and, most of these guys are probably pretty good guys, but this one evil guy,
yeah,
he's the one that's the problem, and, we really should have done something about him, and this riot never would have happened. And I'm like,
so you thought this whole big section that takes place in the middle is kind of boring.
Well, it's boring and it's not coherent. Like, I don't see how that's, like, if you're trying to, like, logically figure out why, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like a microcosm of the bigger riots. So it did. This is an event that did occur.
Yes.
But I don't think it merits, like, you naming it this thing Detroit. You should have named it Algiers.
The Algiers, right? Yeah. Exactly. It feels kind of random in light of what we've started with, where we thought the film was going. Again, Detroit, yeah. Right.
Also, in our historical context right now,
mm.
it doesn't even, like, enter this dialogue that's so rich. Like, it could have really been a film that would have entered in and tried to at least be provocative mm-hmm. or give meaning
mm-hmm.
or create a narrative that would at least inspire us to have dialogue. This does none of that.
No.
It's just like really, it's not engaging for anyone.
No.
I don't know who is engaging this. It comes off as like a really bad, like, terrorists that have hostages at the bank.
Right, right.
And that it just happens to be this guy hates black people.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that's not very compelling. It does have tension, but it feels canned.
Yes, it does. Does it feel exploitative to you? So you basically have these scenes where Krause is trying to get to the bottom of who the shooter is. So he'll take one of the black people and is like, all right, well, I've got to kill one of you now. And he'll take him into the back room and fake like he killed the person and say, don't say anything. And then, these people are getting more and more horrified. He ends up beating people up. Does that section begin to feel exploitative, or what do you think? It's just not even,
It's just boring. Like, I know it sounds kind of exciting.
Yeah.
Which is funny, but like the actual movie is just, it was dragging. Mm. It was where I was like, hey, John.
mm-hmm.
Hey, John.
Yes, the look on your face, man, is priceless.
I mean, I felt like we were in a Terrence Malick film for a little bit there.
Yeah, yes.
I was like, oh, well, a later one. So I just thought it just felt canned. Mm. It felt like you could replace those characters with anybody that's got a bias. Mm-hmm. And it, to me, ignores what it says is there's one bad apple out there, and that's the problem. Which, to me, when you talk about exploitive, Like, that to me is a narrative that's counter to there's something deeply wrong in America.
Yeah.
This is saying, oh, that's a bad cop.
Yeah. And even when one of them ends up breaking out of this terrible situation, they're immediately thrust into the arms of a really great cop who's like, oh no, you were hurt. How can I help you? Right. It's it almost feels like excessive. Right. Yeah.
Oh, you know, we're all really pretty cool guys.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying like, because there's good cops, there's bad
sure,
cops. I get all that. But what it's denying is that there's a historical, it's denying that there's a historical issue going on here.
Which is what caused the riot, or this huge contributing factor. Yeah.
So that there's this, that there is something so wrong in our culture that this could exist, that the climate would exist for this, and it's denying any of those cause. It's pointing to false cause, so that's where it's exploited. So to me, it's bad. It's the logic would be, so the real evil person in this situation is this one guy. And what I would say is, no, I think we have a deep social problem.
I agree.
That is, you know, based in turning people into property, and then developing something to justify that over hundreds of years, and then hurting, you know, oppressing people. And so, like, do you want to get in that narrative? Well, apparently Bigelow doesn't want to even have that narrative enter in her film.
No.
And so it's really depressing. It's not complex. It's simple. And in some ways, like, I think about The Hurt Locker is a very simple movie as far as linear, right?
Yeah. But it feels way more complex as a character study.
The character study is really good.
Yeah.
So that's where I go to, like, the Boyega character, and it's like, well, this guy could have been a character study.
Yeah.
Which would have been more interesting. And I think, you and I were both talking about, I'm sorry, I'm not letting you get any words in here, but I think you and I were both talking about, like, how different this is then Do the Right Thing.
Oh my gosh. Even thinking about the movies in comparison with each other just makes it seem even worse than it already was. I mean, and yeah, Do the Right Thing, there's where you have this over expansive view of the city where you see all the little elements that are basically setting up this powder keg that's ready to explode. It earns what happens at the end. And it's like Bigelow wants to go straight to the end and be like, hey, this happened. Like, okay.
Yeah, it just doesn't. It gets into like, this is super complicated and miserable, and it's nuanced, and it gives characters who have real life to them.
Yep,
the hate that people have is real.
Doesn't
the
feel
love
contrived.
That they have is real.
It's a lot
the
of Detroit feels
they have
contrived.
Is real. The joy. Detroit's just like, well, I guess we put Die Hard and we put, you know, we painted it in some race ideas, and we had Die Hard here.
Yeah.
You know, and I
from like a villain aspect, right? Like kind of like you're trapped in a building with these over the top villains, sort of almost.
Yeah, they're like over the top. This guy's just a sadistic creep.
Exactly.
And I think that the real, this gets into like ideas sin, but I think that the real struggle is not that there's a one sadistic creep that we should really like, oh, we should find that sadistic guy and lock him up. The reality is maybe some of the problems are actually us. And I don't feel like Bigelow makes us do any introspection at all. We're just like, we're supposed to like have pure hate for this babyface killer. And it just fails to me. It just totally fails. Cause I'm like, I don't know. I got to save my hate for like that for guys like Bane and you know what I mean? I don't have time for this guy.
Yeah.
He's not evil enough.
And I think it's important to recognize too that, for us as white people, you know, we found it boring. We found we noticed pacing problems, but it very well, I think, might have been received a lot harsher for black people who this is kind of their reality. And they, you know, I think when I was reading the reviews of some of the black critics, they thought they were kind of talking about how ugly it was and how hard it was to watch. And I could see that, you know, and that goes back to just kind of the insensitive way that it was shot. So like there was actually an article I pulled up about kind of the disparity between white critics and black critics and how they're receiving the movie. And, you know, you have these white critics from USA Today, Wall Street Journal, New York Magazine giving glowing reviews. And then you have these black critics, like you mentioned the Roger Ebert reviews. Angelica Beth Stein was the reviewer there. She describes Detroit as this, she says, it's a hollow spectacle displaying rank racism, and countless deaths that has nothing to say about race, the justice system, police brutality, or the city that gives it its title.
Dang.
Yeah.
Oh, that summarizes it.
Yeah, just, that's it.
Turn off your podcast and go read the article.
Right.
And then come back to the podcast.
And she just goes back to the ugliness of it, which, you know, and then in Vibe, Shaniqua Golding says, aside from just telling the story, where Bigelow falls short is the fact that the film is devoid of any real empathy. If the Academy Award-winning director assumes dead black bodies will inspire an outpouring of support as for black people in America, right? As if that, yeah.
Right, because it hasn't, yeah. So what's funny to me is, so we reviewed... What was the one that we reviewed? Nate, I can't remember his film. It was about the Nat Turner one.
Yes, Nat Turner.
What was it called? Was it called Nat Turner?
Birth of a Nation.
Birth of a Nation. That's yes. Right. What am I thinking? I thought Birth of a Nation like entered, as much as I didn't like the redemptive violence themes in Birth of a Nation, I thought it like entered much better into like the, and I didn't agree with everything, but it entered much better into this the contemporary conversation.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Even though it's an event that was like hundreds of years before this event.
Yep. Agreed.
Which is really funny to me. Well, several hundred, not quite 200, I don't think. And I don't remember when the Nat Turner's Rebellion was. But it was funny because like Detroit didn't, this film didn't even enter in. It could have been just an isolated event.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't enter into any dialogue. It doesn't.
We're having these conversations right now. This thing happened 30 years ago. It's just like prime opportunity. You're right. And it just feels like this slice from history that has no bearing on the present. It's very strange.
Yeah.
And there's no strong black character in the movie, right? It's like you have, I mean, it's not like the, okay, so you got the Motown singer Larry, and he's a victim, right? Most of the black characters are victims in the movie, and then you have John Boyega's character, which is sort of this Uncle Tom-like character who's playing both sides. You don't have this really strong, moral, heroic black character out there. I don't know. That feels strange to me.
And no black women.
No black women.
Which I was like, what?
Yeah.
How are you telling this story with no black women? That doesn't make any sense to me. So it's a failure in a lot of ways.
It's just kind of like this really sterile, here's what happened, no nonsense tone, not a lot of beauty, redemption, art. It's just this kind of oppressive film. And, I'm sure it's true to its source material, but it's like, I get what those black critics are saying. It's like, if you're going to bring us through the mud, have a point, have some empathy, have something we're heading towards here. Yeah. You don't get that.
Yeah, just it's just very frustrating.
Yeah.
And the worst part is if this is some crappy filmmaker who just made a bad film, that would be one thing. But this is somebody who's recognized by the Academy as she has a best director.
Best picture in 2010 and best director. Okay. I didn't know that. She won Best Picture for The Hurt Locker, which is a great movie about these like bomb diffusers in Iraq. See that. Zero Dark Thirty had a little more problems, but it was still very well made. She's a great director. There's no question.
So what's funny is like when we look at like a couple years ago at the Oscars, right?
Mm-hmm.
This idea of people, this is the example of this. The ultimate example of like, well, is there black folks in Hollywood that are getting their stories made? And this is not the case.
With the Oscar So White campaign.
Yeah. You're taking somebody that co-opted the black experience, claims to understand it through this movie in some ways, and then creates something that is kind of appalling.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just calling it as I see it.
Yeah, yeah.
And... So I just don't. And then this made how many different people cleared this to happen?
Right.
How many people read that script? How many people were like saw this and didn't have a problem with it? Or maybe I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
But to me, it's some like the first couple of scenes. I was like, what?
Mm-hmm.
This film is full of some problems.
So if you had to look beyond the vehicle that we've talked about here. What are some thematic elements that you were able to take away from Detroit that maybe, if you had to?
I don't know, man. It honestly just felt like a hostage situation movie. I don't feel like there was much thematic elements. I felt like there's the stylistic elements was this like ultra shaky camera documentary, like war correspondent style footage with really weird lighting. And that almost made people look not like people, which is really interesting. It was just strange to me. I'd say it was strange. I don't have any thematic elements. I mean, I guess.
Well, I took a couple away, okay. Despite the problems that we mentioned. So, first of all, Krauss says something that I thought was pretty profound. I actually wrote it down when I was in the theater. He says, something that took 1 minute should not define your entire life. I thought that was really a profound thing from a police perspective. Now, he's saying that to a police officer who basically made a mistake on the job that got someone killed. And he says, something that took 1 minute should not define your entire life. And
well, didn't you call it a mistake? Didn't he kill somebody?
He killed someone. I'm just saying, he mistaken.
He killed him.
Well, yes.
He
that's
made a mistake,
happened.
But how mistake? He,
right, right.
He thought
right.
he was killing somebody.
Right, yes. But I think that's extremely relevant to some of the situations and the conversations that we've been having over the last few months with these police incidents. You know, the problem with that statement is that for a police officer, it might be this 1 minute in time that they don't want to define the rest of their life. But for a Philando Castile, that does define your life. It defines the lives of the people who are around you. And if those of you who don't know, Philando Castile was the guy who was pulled over a few months ago. The video footage had leaked about he was pulled over for a broken taillight. And when he went to get his wallet, the officer thought he was reaching for a gun. And in a moment of panic, he fires his weapon like 6 times into the car and he's dead. And his girlfriend's in the passenger seat and you have a little girl, their daughter, in the back seat. So that 1 minute, while the officer desperately wants the jury to just say, hey, you made a mistake, move on with your life. How does that 1 minute impact the girlfriend, the girl in the back seat? So I thought that was interesting because you see the logic for a second from the police perspective, but yeah.
But if you look at, so I know you're getting into the theme of that, mm-hmm. but if you look at that as some isolated event that has nothing to do with American history and nothing to do with systemic oppression of groups of people, then it's just an isolated event that happened, and it's kind of like, well, that shouldn't happen. This is bad. That's a bad cop.
Mm.
Right?
Yep, yep.
So when I'm looking at the narrative that this film is really, I mean, now you're getting me thinking about thematic stuff.
Good, yeah.
The narrative is really saying, well, these are probably all just these isolated bad cop incidents.
Yeah, or
you're
even...
You're like, the hell they are, right?
Exactly.
You're like,
or even
what's going on.
How quickly the conversations, you know, in modern day, when we have an incident like Philando Castile, I would have conversations, and what do people say? Well, you know, he should have put his hands on the steering wheel or something. It's almost like we want to even make it an isolated incident if the person had just done this, that, or the other thing, instead of saying, well, why is this like the 8th time we're talking about this in the last 3 weeks? You know, it's like, yeah, I get what you're saying. Totally. We want to make it this one thing.
So is this movie like is probably a good example of denial.
Mm.
So how deep the denial goes. So it's a good example of our sense of like, we have to justify this in some way or remove. We have to be once removed from the American history that we are living in or living into. Hmm. So it's too hard for us white folks to think about it as it actually is. So we have to create these like sub narratives that are small enough for us to like really deal with.
To reconcile in our head. So we
don't, we're okay with it. Yep. So like what we see here is the blown up Hollywood version of trying to reconcile this in someone's head.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes off as kind of psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's like some of the reviews of it.
Yeah.
It's this, trying to force a narrative on something that clearly doesn't yield itself to it.
Here's another takeaway that struck me. The John Boyega character, the security guard who's black, and he understands on one level that there's injustice happening to people in his community, but on the other hand, you know, he's giving coffee out to the people who are oppressing his community because he doesn't want to make waves. He's there when Krauss is doing these sadistic games, but he doesn't say anything. He's troubled. His face is troubled, but he stays silent. He stays compliant, doesn't want to rock the boat. I thought of that, especially in the last few weeks with the national conversation around Charleston that's been happening. you know, we live in this time in 2017 where there are neo-Nazis marching in Charleston with tiki torches, shouting blood and soil and Jews will not replace us. And what made my heart even heavier than the actual incident was the reaction to it, you know, especially among Christians, with so many like posts on social media being some variation of, yeah, that was terrible, but, or yeah, there's neo-Nazis, yeah. But, you know, and the but is what worries me, because I just feel like there's some things we have to be unequivocal about. And it really just kind of reminded me of this character, that John Boyega plays, is kind of this guy that wants to straddle the fence, you know, when in reality he needs to say something because his silence gets people killed.
Yeah, I think his character is interesting because he's trying to keep people alive, like right now. He's like, I want you to survive this.
Right.
And I think there's a great deal. I think that's an interesting idea, which is, I'm trying to survive this. What is this?
Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I can't solve this whole problem, but I can at least help you survive this one moment.
Do you want to live
tonight? Right.
And then we could talk about it later.
Interesting.
I think that's where the unmined gold is in that idea.
Yeah.
Which is, you know what? We might be right about something here, but tonight we're going to survive.
Yeah.
And I think that is that. Why didn't Bigelow like go for that? Because that idea is really interesting.
That is.
And it really gets largely untouched.
Mm. Mm.
So, well, how much must we kind of hide and deny and put a face up in order to just make it through?
Here's another thing I was just thinking of when you were talking before about how we want to make it this one thing. When I was, it was like a light bulb went off. So I was just talking about Charleston. It's when we want so badly for it to just be. It's just like, oh, of course Nazis are bad, right? Like neo-Nazis are bad. Like we want to make this whole thing about that one thing so that all of us can just be agreed. Like, yep, it's, you know, there's nothing really newsworthy here. Nazis are bad. They came out of this hole and there they were and now they're gone and we can move on, instead of actually looking at, well, wait a second. What are the steps that made these people totally unafraid to be out there without masks in broad daylight when a year ago there was still shame surrounding that whole movement? You know, what is the racism and prejudice and injustice that is happening on a daily basis in our legislation, in our education system, in our prison system, in our war on drugs, in everything that's happening there? And frankly, what is the injustice that's happening when we look in the mirror? What is the implicit racism that's happening in our own hearts that allows this kind of thing to happen? So we so badly just want it to just be about these crazy Nazis, right? Just, if it can just be about that, then I don't have to think anymore about what I'm, the systemic part of it, which is what you were saying before.
If it's exceptional, then mm-hmm. we're not part of it.
Mm.
So if it's KKK members and Nazis, oh, we're good. We're not KKK members and Nazis.
Yep.
So then we don't bear any blame. We're clean.
Yep.
And what's Denzel saying in Glory? Ain't nobody clean. That's another co-op of the Black Experience.
Was that Spielberg again? Glory?
I don't remember. I don't remember it, but it was that whole. There's problems with that whole film. But in any case, I have a problem with it. It does once again, just like the never ending internet social media stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It betrays more about the people who are defending, who come up with these bizarre counter narratives. It shows you more about who they are and where their guilt lies. Most of the things I see is people are just trying to. I see a lot of folks that want people to tell the truth. There's not, sometimes there's other demands, but they're not, or acknowledge someone's experience as legitimate historically.
What do you mean by that exactly? Unpack that.
So I guess what I'm saying is most of the folks I talk to just want to say, well, is there a history of injustice and systemic oppression and the destruction of Black bodies and all these things? Does that exist? Mm-hmm. Yes or no?
Because that really is still being debated.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's clear, like, it does exist.
Of course it
does. And you got to be at it. And you have to create some kind of fantasy to deny that.
Yep.
And so what's funny is like the, this is a, some kind of fantasy to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
And it does deny this greater narrative. That's why it's so offensive.
Yeah.
Which is funny because it's like on the surface, it's like, well, I can imagine Bigelow screams, why don't black folks like this movie? I feel like I totally happened into this idea.
Yeah.
Like this
made it for
white,
you. Right.
This evil white cop.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, because it's probably more about, it's less about the evil white cop and more about the history.
Yeah.
So are we going to acknowledge this history or are we going to try to create a narrative that makes it so we don't have to?
Yeah. All right, man. That's it. Final thoughts on Detroit plus your letter grade. This is it. Go for it.
Don't go see this because you're putting money in the wrong spot. That's why I say right against it. If you go, if you're going to see it, watch it. Maybe help it. Maybe it can help you expose some of your own narratives that you're creating to protect yourself, and maybe try to be more open to history.
Yeah.
And listen to the people who are living it, not the people who are. This is a secondhand account, right?
Right.
But yeah, I find it offensive. Go watch a better movie. Go watch Get Out. Mm-hmm. Go watch...
Do the Right Thing, please.
Do the Right Thing. Go watch Moonlight. Yeah. And I'm saying this like because those are actual movies about the black experience from black directors, black writers, or James Baldwin's film, that are thought-provoking, and they're just good. Like, they're good films.
Good art.
This is just not a good film,
it's not.
Right?
No.
So it's offensive and a crappy film. So, stick to your, soldiers blowing up stuff, I guess, for Bigelow. And it's disappointing because I really like Bigelow.
Yeah, me too.
And so it's a real bummer that this is what she came out with.
So what grade are you going to land on?
I would give this probably a C-.
All right. I had high expectations for this one, I tell you, and they were not met. I just wish Bigelow had fallen through with the title, like that this really was Detroit. And for a little bit, it feels like that's what it's going to be, but that it's going to be like this modern do the right thing. But it's not the path that it went down, unfortunately. And so, it could have been a great film. Like we said, all the pieces are there. The actors are there. You have these hidden gold elements that really beg to be mined that just get ignored. And Bigelow is a talented director. There's no question about it. But it's just it wasn't executed well. And it was rough. It was choppy and borderline offensive in places. So I am giving it a C+. That is my grade. And it's all the more sad because there are so many important themes that line up with the conversations that we're having today. And I just wish there was a better vehicle for them in this movie. And it's sad.
What a waste of like resources, man.
Mm.
I mean, there's all these, I know I talk about this all the time.
Yeah.
You got these young artists out there that have good stuff. And then this is what studios are making.
Yeah.
It's just disappointing to me.
I'm with you. So, Tim, should we try again next month for a Stephen King adaptation?
You know I'm afraid of this one.
Like, do you want to try for it? You want to try for
I'm
it?
I'm like really afraid because I remember watching the other one. I'm afraid of that clown.
It clown looks so scary in the trailer, man.
Yeah, I'm totally terrified.
Do you
want to?
Let's just do it. Let's do it. Right. I think we're going to try for it. Now, we will say the caveat that if the reviews are as bad as The Dark Tower, we will probably be skipping it again. But hopefully, Stephen King can have one good adaption for the summer here. So, well, it won't be the summer. It'll be next month. But anyway, I'm hoping.
I hope we don't have to flush the whole year. Maybe we just don't have the awards this year. We're just like...
just can you cancel imagine the awards.
Like, no, gosh. We're done now. We didn't have anything. We had nothing.
So tune in next month. We're going to try to see it and review that for you. We'll see how it goes. But hopefully we'll be talking about a good Stephen King movie here.
Can I ask you one question
please?
Before you sign off here?
Yes.
What is your favorite movie of the year so far?
My favorite movie of the year is Dunkirk.
Isn't that it? It's a great movie.
But
it's not like a great movie.
It's an A-. It's not a... right. I know. It's... Yeah.
And there's nothing even like close to it. Like what's like?
Well, yeah, I forget what my number two is. I think it's that Netflix movie. I don't want to live in this world anymore, whatever it is. But that's a B plus, and
that's like nowhere near that.
Yeah, I'm telling you, we got spoiled last year. It was just like good movie after good movie, and this is the off year. This is the punishment for having a great year in film with two masterpieces. Man, I'm telling you,
it's a terrible year.
It sucks. All right, so yeah, there you go. Please don't forget to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, a little mini review for us. It helps us so, so much. And also drop us a line. podcast@cinemafaith.com is our email address. podcast@cinemafaith.com. We'd love to hear from you. What do you think we're doing right? What do you hate? What's your opinion on Detroit? Please talk to us.
Did we miss something in our review?
Exactly.
Do you want to help everyone understand this better? Maybe we like... There's some kind of, you know, German philosopher that you read and they help us understand this and we missed it. We're okay with it.
And we will read your email on air and we'll just talk about it. So please give us your feedback. We'd love to hear from you. Tim, great talking film with you, man. Hopefully next month will bring us a better film. And yeah, keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.